When Ian Manuel committed the crime that got him sentenced to life behind bars without parole, he was 13 years old. He had turned 14 by the time he was locked up in an adult prison, but was still small enough that guards couldn't find a uniform to fit him. By the following year, he was placed in solitary confinement and would remain there for the better part of two decades. Manuel's original offense was indeed very serious. He had shot a woman in the face during a botched robbery attempt. But it's hard to hear his story and not wonder, is this how we want our criminal justice system to work? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Manuel did get out of prison a few years ago, 26 years after he went in. He's now a poet, a motivational speaker, and author of the book My Time Will Come, a memoir of crime, punishment, hope, and redemption. He joined us in 2021. Ian, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris. That was a great introduction.
Well, thank you. You write that the stories told about your life all tend to begin with crime. So let's begin with the one that sent your mother to prison very soon after you were born. What happened there, and what did that mean to you for the first years of your life?
From my understanding, you know, I was a child. I was a very baby, but my brother went into a neighbor's yard. And the neighbor had previously told my brother not to come playing in her yard. My brother was about 9 or 10 at the time. And the lady hit my brother. And my brother ran in the house telling my mother that the lady next door had struck him. And my mother, in return, took action and shot the lady. And I don't know what part of the body the lady shot her in, but I do remember that the gun was supposedly a .32 caliber type of weapon, which sadly was the same type of gun used in my crime. Hmm.
Your mom had not wanted to have a baby, another baby, when she got pregnant with you, and she told you this on a regular basis. Do you know why she went ahead with the pregnancy anyway?
Yeah, according to the story that I've heard over and over again, the neighborhood matriarch, Big Mama, in the neighborhood, convinced her to have the baby because she was dead set on having an abortion. The neighborhood matriarch, Big Mama, convinced her to go through with the pregnancy. And as a result, Ian Manuel was born.
Your mom seemed to really hate the color of your skin, the darkness of it. What did you do to try to fix that as a little kid, to make her love you more?
Sadly, I did things to my body that I shouldn't have done. I go to the pool, and I always heard that the chlorine would burn your skin if you didn't wash it off. And so I thought that it would make me lighter if I got out of the pool with the chlorine on my body, walking home with the sun beaming down on my body. The lifeguards would always yell at me, get under the shower. And I'd ignore them. And then there was times that I'd take the bleach that she used to wash the clothes to pour it into half a gallon in the bathtub with the water running. And I'd soak in the bleach water in the bathtub to try to become a color of a child that my mother would love.
I mean, it didn't work to lighten your skin, and I guess it didn't work to keep her from resenting you.
No, not at all. And sadly, you know, I'm not that type of person. I love the darkness of my skin now. But as a child, you know, you crave a mother's love. And I guess she loved me in her own way, but it was a tough love, man. And growing up, I didn't know that the type of love that she was giving me was not normal for a child to experience.
She beat you pretty often, but you say it was her words that hurt you more than the physical abuse, and yet you couldn't keep from loving her. Why do you think that was? Why did you love her?
I just think in the environment I grew up in, it was instilled in you to love your mother because she gave you life. Even though she didn't want to give me life, she did go through with the pregnancy. And I so appreciate these questions. These are questions I've probably never been asked before, at least not the way that you're asking them. And I love my mother because she did try her best. She always made sure that there was food on the table. She always made sure there was a roof over my head. and that every Christmas and every birthday that I had a reason to celebrate.
What did she know about the sexual abuse your older brother subjected you to?
She didn't know much. She only knew one day when she was changing my clothes, and she was trying to buckle up my pants or something, and she noticed I didn't have any underwear on. And long story short, I don't remember the actual incidents that much. As a defense mechanism, blocked them out of my mind. But I just recall her asking me, "Ian, where's your underwear? Where's your underwear?" And I was stuck. I was stuck and didn't want to respond to her. And she shook me. "Where's your underwear? Where's your underwear?" She just kept shaking me until I just started crying. And I said my older brother's name a couple times. And she immediately picked up the phone, called 911, and he was arrested.
But when he came back from juvenile detention 6 months later, you were back from a foster placement while this case was going through. He went right back into the same bedroom you two shared, and nobody ever mentioned it again.
Yeah, no one ever mentioned it again. But thankfully, nothing ever happened again. And that's something I'm grateful for. But from a therapeutic standpoint, I think it's something that we should have talked about so both of us could heal from.
Do you love your brother?
My brother's dead. He died while I was incarcerated. I don't know. Love is a strong word. I felt betrayed by him. So I did care for him deeply as an older sibling, you know. And so I just felt betrayed by what he did to me.
So your grandmother, Linda, became a really important person to you. What do you remember about the time you used to spend with her?
Oh, man, Grandma Linda. The time I used to spend with Linda, man, was some of the best times of my young life. To have someone love me unconditionally, to provide for me no matter what I wanted, I felt like I could have walked into the mall and asked for her to buy the entire cookie store and she would have did it. The sad thing about my grandmother, I talk about it in my book, My Time Will Come, but she used to get a retirement check. She worked 26 years at Morrison's Cafeteria. And she used to stand in that hot kitchen. And a lot of times people ask me where I get the resolve to withstand all the time I spend in solitary confinement. I know we'll get to that later in the conversation. But I think about those years. I walked in that kitchen one time when my grandmother took me there after she retired, and the kitchen was so hot. It was a big sprawling kitchen, man, in Tampa Bay Mall. But inside that kitchen, it was so hot, and she had to stand on her feet for 8-12 hours a day cooking meals just to support herself, man. And she did that for 26 years. And when she retired, she used to take me to Tampa Bay Mall to cash her checks. And I still remember being afraid that we were going to get turned away at the bank, because she, every time, without fail, she would give the bank teller her check, and the bank teller would say, "Just sign the checks and we'll get you your money, Ms. Johnson." And she would always say, "I don't know how to spell my name." And the bank teller would say invariably, "Well, that's okay. Just mark an X and that'll fine. That'll be fine. That'll suffice as a signature." But I think about something that my grandmother couldn't read or write, and that's something that I do as easy as inhaling and exhaling. So it's always been a myth to me that that's my gift, and it's something that she couldn't do.
And she paid for you to go to Catholic school, which helped you fall in love with learning.
Yes, yes, yes. St. Peter Claver Catholic School in Tampa, Florida, man. I like going to that school. I just didn't like the rigidness of the color clothing that we had to wear back then. I was anxious to get to a public school where I could wear my own clothes, you know?
So your grandmother developed symptoms of dementia and needed to go into a long-term care facility. The last time you saw her, you were 11. That was the same year your mom was diagnosed with HIV. You think of 11, that year, as the end of your childhood.
Yes, yes, yes. So many things went wrong that year. My grandmother developed dementia, went and moved back to Cordell, Georgia. So I no longer had that rock I could depend on right there around me, man. She went back home to live with her family on my dad's side. My mother developed AIDS, caught AIDS, and I received my first charge, my first charge as a juvenile in 1989. So it was a tumultuous, tough year for me.
So nobody's taking care of you at home. You need money. Before you started getting into trouble, you had a plan, kind of a straight plan to get a job. Talk about that.
Yeah. So I still remember it like it was yesterday. I was inside the Boys and Girls Club in Tampa in Central Park Village. I told my friend Ronald McClendon, I said, man, let's go downtown and look for a job. And he's like, a job? Who's going to hire us, man? We're kids. I said, man, just let me do the talking, man. Just let me do the talking. And so we went downtown. And one of the first places we stopped was the Young Men's Christian Association, the YMCA. And we went into the YMCA where they exercise at, and I asked to speak to the manager, and the manager came over and I said, I'd like to get a job here working. And he's like, I can't hire you. You have to go talk to the administrative office right across the walkway there. So we went next door. I told the secretary in that office, I'd like to apply for a job. And I'm laughing at it now because it just seems so incredulous that I would even think of something like this. And then the CEO, Bob Gilbertson, called me. She said, let me ask my boss. And he called me into his office and he sat us down. He says, what can you guys do? And I said, man, we can clean, we can sweep, we can organize stuff for you. We can just keep this place pretty clean for you. And he said, okay, guys, well, you know, I'll tell you what. I'm going to give you some money to go get some pizza and come back and then we'll discuss it. I think then he was trying to test us to see what we really bring the money back. Mm. And we brought the money back and he actually gave us a job working at the YMCA, cleaning off the bikes, cleaning out the locker rooms and wiping the windows down and then bringing us to his house to wash his car and clean out of his apartment sometimes, man. Not his apartment, his house. And then he'd take us to the yacht club. And I seen that two different Tampas existed. There was the poor side. Before this, I didn't know there was a middle-class America. But he took us to the yacht club, and I seen all these different races and people in this yacht club. And we go to his sailboat, and I'm terrified of water. We didn't get to go out that day because it was a terrible storm. But Bob became like my surrogate father, man. He was like the dad I always wanted.
All right, Ian. So you had Bob Gilbertson, but I mean, one person, even if that person cares a lot, is not really enough. By sixth grade, you were getting in trouble in school all the time. You didn't realize it at the time, but the fact that you couldn't sit still was a symptom of the many traumas you'd already experienced.
Agreed. And I believe I had ADHD as well, ADD. I was trauma after trauma after trauma. And I eventually ended up committing a big crime that landed me in prison.
All right, so let's talk about that big crime. You were 13. You and your mom were technically homeless at the time, crashing at the home of a friend in a housing project. How did the idea come about on this particular night that you and some friends would mug somebody?
Well, it wasn't even, it wasn't hatched. It was not something that we talked about, man. All I remember is I was sitting on the porch of my then, I guess you can call her my girlfriend. We were 12 and 13 at the time, and I kept trying to convince her to go upstairs with me, and she wasn't having it. And my a friend of mine came by and was like, Ian, let's go to the game room. And I was like, no, I'm chilling with my girl. I don't want to go to the game room. Another friend came and tried to convince me to go to the park, and I didn't want to go to the park. And finally, hours had went by, and another friend came. And by this time, I'm frustrated that my girlfriend didn't want to go upstairs with me. And because, you know, last time we went upstairs, I had told my mom what happened. And my mom had told her mom. And so the trust thing had been broken. But I had to explain why I had been out of the house so long. I had an 11 o'clock curfew at 13. And if I didn't make that curfew at 11 o'clock, my mom wouldn't let me in the house, you know? But the friend came and gave me, he said, Ian, I have a gun. Let's go jacking. Jacking was the street terminology back then for robbing. And I was so frustrated at the time. And in my childlike imagination, I'm like, if I go with him, she'll call me back and say, no, don't go. Let's go upstairs. Well, things never work out quite like in your childlike imagination as you would have them in reality. And so we met up with two older kids. I was the youngest. It was a guy 18, 16, and the guy that came to get me was 14, and I was 13. We went downtown looking for someone to rob, and they kept trying to do it in open areas, like this open area with a bunch of people, and they gave me the gun, and I just didn't want to do it. I just felt like we're going to get arrested, man, if we do this in such an open area. So we roaming around downtown for an hour or two, and it started to get dark. And finally, the older guy got frustrated, and he said, all of us sat on the curb, and the older guy said, Ian, if you're not going to do it, give the gun to somebody else who will. And so I gave the gun to my my friend that came to get me off of the porch. And he passed the gun to the guy next to him, his cousin. He passed the gun to the older guy. So now we're sitting there passing this gun back and forth like a hot potato. And finally, the guy that came to get me off the porch gives me the gun and says, I know he'll do it, man. We've been on these type of escapades before. He'll do it. And so we make a pact that the next person that we approach, no matter if it's in the open or not, we're going to rob them. And we turned around and we didn't have far to look because it was a couple standing in front of a car in a parking lot. And the older guy and the guy that came to get me off the porch approached them and asked for change. I thought I heard them say, yes, we got change. I pulled out my gun and Debbie screamed, startled me. I fired, and that one bullet changed the trajectory of both our lives.
Debbie is the woman you shot that you didn't know at the time.
No, I didn't know her at the time. I didn't know Debbie at the time, no.
So she survived, but you ended up being charged as an adult because Florida law allowed for that at the time. And we should note, this is the era when politicians were talking about the dangers of so-called super predators.
Yes.
Were you positioned as a super predator?
I believe I was. And I just want to say that law is still on the books. It's not something that was changed. It's a law that says a child of any age that's indicted for a life or death felony shall be treated in every respect as if he were an adult. So that means a child can be 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. If the state prosecutor wants to charge him as an adult for a life felony, he can. And so I just want to, that's a law that I'm fighting to change. And I want that law changed and eradicated from the books because no child should have to go through what I went through in my life, man.
I want to be clear. I want to ask about this. I mean, you are obviously frustrated and outraged at the punishment that was given to you when you did this thing at such a young age. It's not that you don't feel responsible for what happened. Am I right about that?
You're definitely right about that. Even my victim, who's my friend now, Debbie Bagri, in a New York Times article said, had Ian been a blonde hair, blue-eyed white boy, he would have never been sentenced to life in prison without parole. So it's not something that I'm like saying myself. Even the lady that I shot is saying this, you know. And I've been remorseful. I did. As we get to the more in the story, You know, people need to know that when I was 14 years old, I picked up the phone and did something that no one would have ever done probably. And that's, I called Debbie. I called Debbie Collette at Christmas time of 1991. And I, back then we had live operators. You could just press zero. And I said, a collect call from Ian to Debbie. I found her address and her phone number in my legal documents and in a police report. And the operator said, you have a collect call from Ian. Do you accept? And Debbie said, can you ask him his last name? And I said, Manuel. Debbie accepted the call. She said, yes, I accept. And then I just remember saying, Miss Bagley, I called to wish you and your family a Merry Christmas and to apologize for shooting you in the face. And then Debbie asked me something that no 14-year-old child should ever have to answer. She said, Ian, why did you shoot me? And I said, Miss Bagley, it all happened so fast. It was a mistake. And we talked for 15 minutes and the call was up. And I asked, could I call back? She said, yes, I called back. And I don't remember much about that second phone call, but I do remember how it ended. I said, Miss Bakery, can I write you? She said, yes. And that's how our correspondence started. And that's, we are the epitome of a restorative justice before it was even something that was big in the world. You know, I initiated restorative justice and didn't even know I was doing it.
Did you ever ask her? I mean, it's pretty extraordinary that she accepted those charges on this call from the kid in prison who had shot her. Why did she agree to talk to you that Christmas Eve?
I remember from an interview, a reporter asked her that question, and she said, morbid curiosity.
Huh?
She said morbid curiosity was the reason she accepted that call. But I'm just so glad she did, because it gave me an opportunity to express my remorse for something that I did. And I wasn't raised like that. I didn't mean to hurt nobody, man. And I'm so, for the judge to take my life when I didn't take a life and never intended to take a life. And I'm so glad Miss Bakery survived, that Debbie survived. Because when I was in prison, you know, I'm getting ahead of the story, but when I was in prison, and after every execution at Florida State Prison, invariably I would turn on NPR News and I would listen in solitary confinement on a small transistor radio. And there would be the victim's family saying, yes, justice has been served. This is what my mom, my dad, my uncle, my aunt, my sister, my brother would have wanted. Debbie didn't die, so no one could say that for her. She survived, and we all, the world, got to see what she really wanted. She wanted me to have a second chance at life.
You had been briefly in juvenile detention before. What was different when you were locked into an adult prison for the first time?
Oh, man. Adult prison and juvenile detention centers, like night and day, man. The seriousness of it. Like, you know, people sleep with knives under their pillows for protection. There's rapes that happens in prisons. I wasn't raped, but there's rapes. There's officers killings. There's killings. There's suicides. Your life is on the line every day of the week. There's as a child, you have to come up with a defense mechanism to survive, because you're surrounded by guys that wake up with the mentality on how to get over on the next man every day of the week, because a lot of people don't have any family support in there. So they have to what's called live off the land, which is prey on people that have money coming in. So you have to soak this stuff up, man, and condition yourself to survive it.
And you were still growing at the time. You were so small, they couldn't find a uniform to fit you.
Yeah, they couldn't find a uniform to fit me. When I first went to prison in the reception center, they put me in solitary confinement for the first 3 weeks of my incarceration because of my age and my size and for protection. But then when I was transferred to my permanent camp institution in prison, they put me right with adults. There was no, you're 13 or you're 14 at the time, you got to be with juveniles. They put me right with adults, man. So I had to grow up fast. And then a year later, I was eventually placed in solitary confinement because I was, and you might wonder, why was I placed in solitary confinement and why for so long? Well, you know, I was given all the responsibilities of an adult at 13 and 14, and I rebelled, man. The officers would yell at me. I'd yell back. I'd be in unauthorized areas. I just did a lot of teenage things, right? But instead of being punished and grounded and sent to my room, I was sent to solitary confinement. And eventually, I stayed in solitary confinement for 18 consecutive years, from 1992 to 2010.
Ian, what is it like in solitary confinement? Like, what's a typical day, a typical week in that kind of situation?
It's hard to describe, man, because each solitary confinement at each prison is different, but it's a lot of monotony, man. Just you come up with things to break up the monotony of the day. There's a cell, you could take about 7 or 8 steps from the back wall to the front door. There's a lot of people playing chess with a piece of paper that they've made out of, made a chessboard out of with paper pieces. And yelling out chess moves. 13 to 29 is the first move. There's the nurse coming on the way to distribute psychotropic medication to people to be able to sustain solitary confinement. And then there's me learning how to write poetry to provide a therapy to myself because I didn't cry. There was so much pain inside, and I would just push it down. And poetry became the way that I express myself. And there's times that they let you out and use PBS as a punishment. PBS was. I talk about it in my book, My Time Will Come. They let me out of my cell one day. And because prisoners like to watch sports and entertainment. And if you force the officers to do their job and let you out of your cell for an hour to watch TV, they punish you by putting the TV on PBS. Well, it backfired on them this particular day because there was a documentary on called To Be Heard. And it was about three South Bronx teenagers that learned to express themselves through poetry. And I like to share one of my poems that, because I couldn't wait to get back in my cell. And express myself to this new form of poetry that I had learned. And it was called slam poetry. I had only been exposed to academic poetry, poetry on the page. And I went back to my cell. Do I have time? Do we have time for a poem?
Absolutely.
And I went back to my cell and I composed this poem called Every Time I Breathe. And I like to share it with your listeners. And it says, every time I breathe, I feel the need to justify my existence. To take this moment that I'm living and enjoy every millisecond in it. My life and my struggles, not many can comprehend it. My desire for freedom burns like a sausage inside a skillet. Tomorrow isn't promised, so I'm thankful for this minute. Though in prison, merely existing, it's like my life has been suspended. But that means it's temporary because I haven't been expelled. And I still got a chance as long as I can in and exhale every time I breathe. Every time I breathe, I'm thankful for the oxygen from the trees and little things like little bees that get overlooked until they sting. Every day I'm faced with obstacles that block the progress to my dreams. But the blockades only masquerades like costumes on Halloween. I've been through enough pain to make a sane man just scream. But instead, I take a deep breath and just breathe. Every time I breathe, the cosmos come out of my nostrils like particles of product coming out of your console. My soul is like a chihuahua you didn't include in your carpool. My lungs relax and collapse like a bottom sitting on a bar stool. Every time I breathe, every time I breathe, I become an intergalactic being. Stepping out of character like a chiropractor, snapping peas. I prayed so many times, it's like I got arthritis in my knees, but I still get down and bow my head because I continue to believe that as long as I can breathe, God's gonna make a change. And my circumstances are only chances for me to glorify his name. You don't know me, homie, but there's odds I've already overcame. So if praying works, but hurts, then I can stand a little pain. I want to end this part by thanking God for bringing me to these heights. And I make a promise to always honor and cherish this breath of life every time I breathe. Every time I breathe. Every time I breathe.
So, Ian, obviously writing has been important to you for a long time. And thank you for sharing your poem. You know, there are a million reasons why going to prison at such a young age is disadvantaged and you know, I think many people would say patently wrong. One thing you had going for you, maybe the only thing you had going for you, is that you say you had the imagination still of a child. How did you use that imagination to keep yourself from falling apart?
I fantasized about what I was going to do when I got out. I fantasized about ways to write different poetry. You know, I started writing poems and sharing them with my fellow prisoners, and they started paying me to write their girlfriend's poems and stuff. My imagination, you know, Albert Einstein, one of the greatest thinkers of our time, said, imagination is more important than knowledge. And so I used my imagination, man, to catapult me, man, on a journey to survive. You know, there's a thin line between imagination and schizophrenia. And the way I like to describe it in solitary is, imagine a fish underwater that has to come up for air every now and then. Even if you look at a fish in a goldfish in a tank, they always come up for that little breath of fresh air. Imagine that breath of fresh air being reality, right? And people who develop schizophrenia, they just dived underwater and they never came up for that breath of fresh air of reality. People who use their imagination to survive always came up for that breath of fresh air of reality, man. And that's basically what I did to survive.
We should note that you spent a lot of those years heavily medicated. And your sense now is that the drugs you were given, the psychotropic medications, were not so much about therapeutic benefit for you. They were about controlling your behavior.
Yes, of course. Yes, that's done throughout every prison system in the Department of Corrections. And not only that, they go to the extreme to sometimes tie you down to beds called 4-point restraints and inject you with psychotropic meds that you don't even need. They call it getting a doctor's order. A doctor, whoever the doctor is on call, all security has to do is convince the nurse that this guy, because they can't gas you with chemical agents when you're in the mental health unit, so they use a different type of chemical agent and those psychotropic medications injecting into your body to control you.
Talk about, I don't think a lot of people know that in certain facilities, prisoners are gassed as a form of punishment.
Oh yeah, gassing it's like this military style mace. So you have the regular mace that, you know, people carry around on them, but imagine a fire extinguisher filled with that stuff, but enhanced with hot peppers inside. And when it gets on your skin, it's like you're roasting for hours and hours and days at a time. It's torture, man, what they do to people in solitary confinement. And what's crazy is this type of chemical agent that they use on these people, individuals in these single cells, they're supposed to be using that in riot situations, not for an inmate that is caught talking on the window, because you're not legally allowed to talk in solitary confinement. You're not allowed to stand on your door in solitary confinement, particularly when a female staff member enters the wing. If you're caught standing on your door looking out when a female is on the wing, they gas you for that. Then they strip you of your clothing, of your mattress, of a blanket to cover your body, and they gas you again. Then they put you on a 3-day starvation meal called a management meal. Actually, 7 days. It's called a management meal, and it looks like all your food. Just imagine going to a restaurant and having all your food put in a blender and baked into a brick loaf and given to you, man. It's horrendous.
Who went to visit you when you were incarcerated?
My social worker, Mariah Morrison, who was hired by Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative, who actually got me out of prison, appealing my case to the U.S. Supreme Court. Brian Stevenson wrote the book, Just Mercy. Brian Stevenson came to visit me. I mostly received visits from the media and my legal team. My lawyer, Ben Schaefer, Tatiana, came to visit me. I only received three personal visits in 26 years. Three personal visits. I mean, my mother's friends came to visit me in 1997, in 2010, and 2015. Those were the only times I received visitation from personal on a personal level. And it's crazy because once I was released from solitary, and I every weekend I'd hope someone would come up to see me. And I stand by the library and I look at the visiting park of people enjoying themselves. And I told myself, I said, someday, nobody wants to come see me now, man. Someday people are gonna have to pay to see me. And I made that dream come true. I hosted a poetry event at Joe's Pub in New York City at the Public Theater, and people paid to see me perform, man. So dreams really do come true.
I know that your mother died when you were behind bars. Why didn't she visit you before that?
That's a great question that I didn't have the answer to. But according to one of my mother's friends, they had offered to drive her up to see me before. And she apparently told them that it would break my heart to go visit my son and walk out of that prison without him coming with me, knowing that he's never getting out of prison. And so that was her excuse for not coming to see me, that it would hurt her to leave me behind.
Your father made contact at one point. How did he reestablish that relationship?
Well, he tried to reestablish it financially by being supported financially by doing things that he didn't do during my childhood. I remember receiving a letter from him in like 1998, and I nearly passed out when the officer slid the letter, the envelope in my cell. I looked at it and flipped it over, said $50, and the name Jimmy Reese was on the envelope. And I'm like, what? And I tore the letter open. My dad couldn't read or write either. He had a girlfriend that wrote his letter for him. And basically the letter said, baby, I'm sorry that I haven't been there for you throughout your life, but I'm here now. I know your mother's gone. Tell me whatever you need, and I got you. I'll do my best to make up for the lost years. And so I just basically told him, you know, I forgive him from not being there, but just support me now, man. This is when I need you more than anything. And, you know, he started ordering me People Magazine, Sports Illustrated, USA Today, the Florida Center Bulletin, and giving me books of stamps. Books of stamps act as commerce in prison. They replace money. So he started sending me 10 book of stamps a month plus money, man. He really tried to make up for not being there as a childhood, during my childhood, man. But I really wish he would have been a dad when I was younger.
What? You had heard from other people who wanted to take up your case based on the very young age you were when you were sentenced to life in prison. Brian Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative were not the first. By the time you heard from them, you had gotten pretty skeptical about folks who said maybe we can help. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, because just a year before, this professor at Florida State University, my favorite school anyway, Florida State University, shout out FSU, but he had said he wanted to take my case, and I sent him all of my legal documents, and I was very hopeful that that he was going to take my case and appeal it and get me out of prison, but he didn't. He didn't take my case. He ended up not taking my case because there was victim injury involved in my case. And he thought that would stop. He thought that would negate a court from ever overturning my sentences. So he sent me all my paperwork back and basically said, sorry, I can't help you. And so a year later, when I get this letter from Brian Stevenson that said, you know, I'm a pro bono, I'm a attorney that won't charge you a dime to appeal your case, man, I still was kind of skeptical because I had just had my heart broken the year before by this professor saying he was going to do the same thing. But Brian proved to be different.
So I wonder what you remember about the day when you were allowed to go free. There was this question of the shoes that you would wear when you finally walked as a free man.
Oh man, that is so great of you to ask that question because my heart was broken in 2011 when I went back for resentencing. And this older lady by the name of Miss Cooper, who had read about me in the newspaper, had bought me some shoes to wear. And I had my social worker, Mariah, bring the shoes to the jail and bring them from Alabama with her just in case I was released. And she ended up driving back to Alabama with that and an Adele CD. I had her bring the Adele CD 21. I think it was 21 at that time. And the song that was very much popular was Someone Like You. And they drove back to Alabama with those shoes and that CD playing on a loop, heartbroken at what the judge had did, because what the judge had did essentially was terminate my life sentence, but resentenced me to 65 years in place of the life sentence, which was a term of years, still a life sentence. But I'm not, it's not an anomaly because that's what's happening all over the United States. Anyway, when I was released, I put those same shoes on that they drove back to Alabama with, and we drove back to Alabama with me in the car with Adele on a loop. And this time things were different. I was a free man.
A lot happens in any person's life between 14 and 40. Most people will finish their education. They'll get their first job. They'll get their second and third jobs. They'll have a partner. They might have children. What was it like to walk into the adult world for the first time at 40 with 26 years lacking of just adult experience in the world?
It was extremely, extremely difficult, and I'm still adjusting. I mean, I'm not as bad as I used to be. I know how to use a computer now, I know how to use a phone, but just crossing the street, I wasn't used to moving objects coming at me. I was terrified of oncoming cars. I had to go through the rigors of trying to apply for an apartment, and I'm still going through that. Trying to find a place to live with no credit history. Leading a guarantor to find a place to stay, not knowing how to cook, not knowing how to drive, having to relearn how to ride a bicycle at 40. It was something that should have been documented, man, by on film so people could see how difficult the reentry process is for people that have went to prison as children and released as adults. But thank God I had the Equal Justice Initiative and Bryan Stevenson on my side. Because had it not been for them, I wouldn't have survived this reentry process.
Yeah, it makes me think of all the people who do their time and get out and don't have anybody helping them. They have all the same struggles. A lot of them end
Yes.
up homeless, right?
Homeless, back committing crimes just to survive. Not because you're a criminal, but because human instincts kick in. You have to provide, you need food and shelter. You know, those are necessities in life.
Are there things, Ian, that you notice about the world as someone who was kept away from it for 26 years that you think those of us who've never been incarcerated maybe fail to appreciate?
Yeah, and you could just see it last year during the pandemic how people were freaking out and having to stay in their homes for all day with their families and stuff. And I was like, you guys got it sweet. I didn't have any of this stuff. Like, you got a TV, you can actually walk out your door when you get ready. You have people you can actually see and touch. And so I don't think people could fully appreciate all the freedoms, just a simple cold glass of water. I had to drink hot water out of a stainless steel sink for 18 years just to survive, or just to feel the cool breeze on your skin, to feel the sun, to see the sun, to actually be able to see the sun on a daily basis. It's so many things. To be able to run your fingers through the grass. You know, I went 20 years without ever touching the grass. It's just things that you want to appreciate, man, once you realize how much they mean to you once they're taken away from you.
That was our conversation from last year with Ian Manuel, a poet and motivational speaker and author of the book My Time Will Come, a memoir of crime, punishment, hope, and redemption. If you like this show, check out our conversation with Carrie Blackinger, who spent 2 years in prison on drug charges and now reports for the Marshall Project. Her memoir is Corrections in Ink. You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter and Instagram. Our handle is at KERATHINK. And subscribe to our podcast for free wherever you get your podcast. Just search for KERATHINK or catch up on the podcast at our website where you can find out about upcoming shows. That's think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.